Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Across the board, from dog catcher to Congress, just one in five elective offices in the United States are held by a woman. This is a long-standing pattern. Since November 2016, an unprecedented number of women and men have coalesced to change that pattern. The president of Emily's List said that in the 2016 cycle, about 900 women contacted the group to talk about running for school board, state legislature, or Congress. Last year, the group heard from more than 11,000 women across the country. Emily's List may be the biggest, but it is no longer the only such group. Republicans also have formed a fundraising organization dubbed Winning for Women. We invited them to join our conversation today. They declined. In Ohio, a statewide PAC called the Matriots formed as well. Joining us now is a member of the Matriots Executive Committee, Rita McNeil Danish. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also by phone, Director of the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University, Debbie Walsh. Welcome back.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Debbie, is this being replicated across the country? Is Emily's List an example of what's going on across the country?
Well, I think what Emily's List has been hearing is something we've been hearing as well. So we actually, at the Center for American Women in Politics, run a nonpartisan campaign training program called Ready to Run, and we have partnerships in quite a few states around the country, including, I'm happy to say, at Ohio State University. And what our programs have seen since the November 2016 election is a tremendous uptick in interest. Normally, our program here in New Jersey, for instance, has about 150 women attend every year. We had 270 women. We had to move to a larger venue. And frankly, if we could have found a bigger space, there were more women we had to turn away. So this is something that is happening across the country, and it is largely being driven, particularly if you look at the House races around the country, on the Democratic side.
Yeah, why do you think?
Well, I think it's so much of what we're seeing here is a response to the election of Donald Trump, and a concern on the part of women across the country that they don't have a voice and that they have not had the kind of power that they need to have in the policy arena to make sure that the issues that they care about are being paid attention to in the way they want them paid attention to. So I think what you've seen here is women saying that they're not willing to sit on the sidelines anymore. They're not going to let somebody else do politics for them. There's a great saying in American politics that if you're not at the table, you're probably on the menu. And I think women were very worried that they were going to be on the menu. And so the solution was to make sure they had a seat at the table.
Money is at the root of a lot of these organizations. That's one. There's, you know, Ready to Run. How much of a focus is on fundraising and the finances of politics?
You know, it's something that we spend, we do a session on. We also run some special sessions during the year on the issue of fundraising. And fundraising is a challenge for women, although we do know from research that women raise comparable amounts of money to men in comparable races. So we know that women are doing it. You know, I don't want women to be afraid to think about running for office because of the money. They just need to kind of take that on as a real piece of the challenge. We know that women come into office from careers and networks that might be a little bit less moneyed. So it might take them, you know, 5 or 10 phone calls to raise that $1,000, whereas a man might pick up the phone and do it in one fell swoop. But there are more and more groups popping up around the country, state-based PACs that are supporting women. There's nothing on par with Emily's List. Frankly, it's the largest PAC in the country. But there are PACs for Republican women. There are PACs at the state level for Democratic and Republican women across the country. And those resources, by the way, we have a map on our website that lists out all the PACs, both national and state-based. So if there are people who want to find out where PACs are that might support their candidacies, I urge them to go there.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about women in politics. There's been a surge of interest by women and for women in politics. If you have a question or comment, have you run for public office? Would you like to run for public office? What do you think the obstacles are, or what have the obstacles been? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. We have a representative of one of those organizations that's popped up since 2017, or 2016, I guess I should say, Rita McNeil Danish. She's an attorney and a member of the Matriots Executive Committee. Rita, tell us how the Matriots formed.
Well, it's actually a very exciting story. You had six women who went to the march back in January a year ago, and they came back from the march and they decided we need to do something. And they were actually at someone's house, our chair and treasurer, Sally Crane Cox, and they were trying to decide what would they do. And so the first part of the conversation, well, is which one of us is going to run? And they all kind of looked at each other and said, well, maybe not, but what can we do? And there's a reality, as you have mentioned, is that the power is in the dollar and the ability to raise and fundraise and bring money in and actually be able to run the ads and do what you need to for a campaign. And so there was a decision after much research, I think, and thought and contemplation that we should develop a statewide PAC. And that's what we did. And so we decided that that PAC would be nonpartisan, because the concept is it's not about the partisan politics, but it's about a vision of making a difference and making an impact as it relates to economic justice for all women, not just women who are Democrats or Republicans.
Go ahead.
And so in July, we started what was called a silent campaign for a founding members campaign. And with that, you were to contribute $1,000 in 2017 and then $1,000 in 2018. And so obviously, we've already had those members, and that founding member campaign ended at the end of December. So those contributions have been made. And then we will be anticipating the contributions from those same pledges for 2018. But to date, we can report that we have $317,000 on hand. We reported $354,000 because that includes in kind. Mm-hmm. But we actually have a total of $750,000 in cash, in kind, and as well in the pledges.
It's nonpartisan. I wanted to ask you, W. Walsh, how unusual is it to have a nonpartisan PAC like this?
It's pretty unusual. There's another PAC like that called the Wolf PAC, for Women Under 40 PAC, which supports women who are running for Congress who are under 40, and there's no litmus test on issues, and there's no party test. I don't know. There are some PACs out there. The Women's Political Caucus has a PAC, National Women's Political Caucus, and local state political caucuses have PACs that are nonpartisan, but they have a litmus test. Those candidates must be pro-choice and must support certain provisions about child care. I don't know if this group has any kind of policy questions that they ask that require certain kinds of answers in order to receive the money. But it is not that common to have PACs that will give to both sides. Now, that's among the women's PACs. Mm-hmm. There are lots and lots of PACs out there, ranging from all sorts of corporate PACs and ideological PACs like the National Rifle Association they'll give to Democrats and Republicans. But again, for instance, with the NRA and possibly with the corporation kinds of PACs, there's also these candidates have to, have a position on certain issues that align with the organization.
Now, I know, Rita McNeil-Danish, you do have a litmus test. Tell us about that.
Well, I wouldn't characterize it as a litmus test,
okay.
But rather or not, if a candidate has values consistent with ours. So we start with the concept of whether or not that candidate is going to ensure equal opportunities, access, and rights and responsibilities, and focus on those issues that are important to women. So we start first with economic justice. And we talk about equality and independence. We talk about access to education. We talk about safe communities in which to live and raise our families. And then we talk about the freedom of choice. Yes, we do. So we don't call it a litmus test because we don't check off the box, but we want to see candidates whose values are consistent with ours, so then when they are at the table, they represent the issues that matter to us and are important to us.
Who all of you, how many candidates or would-be candidates have approached you so far?
So we actually have a deadline that will be announced of February 14th or 15th, because the deadline for filing is February 7th. So at this point, we don't really want to disclose how many candidates, because we want everybody to have opportunity to apply. And so we will know, obviously, after that filing deadline, and then we're extending it a week to allow all of those interested to apply. So ideally, by February 14th or 15th, we will have all the candidates who are interested in applying for our endorsement.
Of course, the filing deadline for the primary is February 7th.
Correct.
Right. So what has been the original goal was about $500,000?
The original goal was $400,000.
Okay, $400,000. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are you surprised by the $350,000, which, or more than $350,000 in hand or in kind, and another $350,000 in pledges? What does that tell you?
I think that I would agree with Debbie that we have a movement, we have a time, and that the time is now. And, you know, my father used to say to me, you're either part of the solution or you're part of the problem. And I think we've all come to the table with a recognition to be part of the solution. And I think that time is right now.
By the way, your PAC isn't, there are men that are behind the PAC as well, right?
That is
this
correct.
This isn't an all-women PAC.
It is not an all-women PAC. So we have a man on our steering committee. We have a man on our endorsement committee, and we do have men who have contributed who are part of the founding member campaign.
Debbie Walsh, is that becoming more of a thing as well?
Oh, I think many, many of the PACs that are out there that support women candidates have men involved in them, at least as donors, and oftentimes, some on boards. But the real question, is, is the money, and I think it sounds like the answer is yes, that the money that's being raised by both the women and the men who are involved with this PAC is to support more women in office.
Is there any sense, Debbie Walsh, too, if someone's going to get money from the Matriots, even if they aren't checking off the box of pro-choice, could it taint a candidate among anti-choice organizations and voters?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Could it be used against them? Maybe Rita.
I see what you mean. Yeah. So if you take pro-choice money, is there a possibility that could be turned on you if you're running against an anti-choice candidate or pro-life candidate? Yeah, I mean, I think that can be used, and I think candidates are strategic about that. So, if you are running for a local council seat, and the issue of abortion does not come up, particularly at the most local of levels, and you're pro-choice, your opponent is pro-life, you might not actively seek out pro-choice money if you don't need to, so that doesn't get raised as an issue, that you can kind of keep it, you can kind of not have to address it, knowing how you might actually vote on something if it ever were to come up. You would be pro-choice, but you don't want to flag it if you're in a place that issue might be something that could be turned against you. I think candidates need to be strategic about that, and I think they always have been. I think that's been one of those patterns in among PAC giving and PAC receiving.
Rita, have you talked about that?
We have talked about it, and we've had a lot of discussion about it. And we recognize that, if you will, the reality of the world that we live in, there are going to be more conservative candidates who might use against, let's say, a Republican woman running, if, in fact, they take an endorsement from the Matriots. But we like to go to a higher level, and we have to bring the conversation to a higher level and not make it about those issues. Also, we don't say we're pro-choice money. So we focus first on the economic justice and the economic access and fairness with wages. But we also want to realize that there are other ways to be helpful and to contribute. So we start with the dollars, obviously, because that makes a difference. Uh-huh. But there's an incredible network amongst women. There is an incredible ability to go door to door. I've run myself, so I know what it's like to get those resources, to get the word out, to go door to door, but also raise money. And so even if it's not about the dollars, we're able able to make a difference, make a contribution, and help get that woman to the table and in office.
Well, Rita McNeil-Danish, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's good to be here.
Rita McNeil-Danish is an attorney. She's also a member of the Matriots Executive Committee. Once again, their deadline for is February 7th. Same deadline is the filing deadline for the primary in May.
Our deadline will be a week after.
Okay.
A week after.
Sorry about that.
So you can go to matriotsohio.com and get an application if you're interested.
We'll continue our conversation about women in elective office, what it takes, what have been the obstacles in the past. And coming up later in the program, we're going to talk about the first woman to run for the United States presidency. Happens to be a native Ohioan back in the 19th century. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about women in politics this hour. Coming up, we recall the life of the first woman to run for the United States presidency, Ohio native Victoria Woodhull. She had several challenges, not least of which was the fact that women still couldn't vote in the late 19th century. These days, roughly 51% of voting age Americans are women. Still, just one in five elective offices are held by women. That's across the board, strangely, from going roughly from about 18% to about 20%, depending on the office. Since the 2016 general election, there has been an unprecedented push to change that metric to better reflect the demographics of the country. Still with us by phone is director of the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University, Debbie Walsh. Joining us now is founder of WillWorkForWomen.com. That's a consulting firm exclusively focused on female candidates here in Columbus, Whitney Smith. Welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me, Ann.
And joining us by phone is public affairs consultant, former communications director for Ohio Governor Bob Taft, and former political columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer, Marianne Sharkey. Welcome to the show, Marianne.
Thank you, Ann. Appreciate it.
You've observed, Marianne, the Ohio political scene of some four decades now. Women candidates and often office holders come and go. They don't seem to stick like the guys do. Why do you think?
Well, you know, it's a very good question because I was looking up the statistics today, too. And we just keep getting stuck in the 20s here. Our state rank is 33. And it seems like we do have times when, you know, good times, like when Betty Montgomery was Attorney General and Joanne Davison was the first woman and now the only woman who was Speaker of the House. Mm-hmm. And there was a period in the late 90s when we had eight women in the Ohio Senate. So actually, we're going backwards right now.
Right.
And I think that, you know, and it's interesting, too, because these women, and they were led by Republican women,
yeah,
were pro-choice women, too. So I think perhaps the social conservatives in the Republican Party may be hurting the candidacies of some of the Republican women who were more progressive and pro-choice.
You know, too, I don't know how much this plays into it, but back when I was covering the legislature, it was just after you had left the Cleveland Plain Dealer Bureau. We sort of were like ships passing in the night. But a lot of the women that were holding a seat in the House and the Senate had inherited it from their deceased spouses. And that was, of course, back in the days before term limits where people served for 150 years, right?
That is correct. And you're right. And
I'm exaggerating.
We know that term limits have hurt women. There's no question about it. The women finally get a foothold there, and then they lose their positions during the term limits because these women, you know, it's hard to raise money and it's hard to get out there, and we continue to not support women candidates. I would love to see it turn around, as I'm sure everybody else would like to see it turn around since we're 51% of the electorate.
Whitney Smith, you've been a candidate for public office. You ran for county commissioner in 2016, right?
Yes.
Tell us about your experience as a Republican, by the way.
Yes, as a Republican, young female candidate, I faced a lot of challenges. So you face the challenge of legitimacy for your candidacy based on your age and being female and being a first-time candidate and not coming from a family dynasty of politicians. You know, no one in my family has held political office. So those were challenges. But you also faced a backlash from your own party and then from the opposition party. So it's really challenging to find your tribe, so to speak. And so when I was running in 2016, I didn't cater to the normal Republican, I guess you would say, values. I did my own thing. I really ran a campaign that was true to myself and true to the values that I thought would really resonate people. And we ended up getting in Franklin County over 200,000 votes, ironically, more votes than Donald Trump. And I really, that's when I came up with the idea to really run movements and not campaigns. And that's, you know, I founded my firm and really decided that, you know, I'm want to prioritize running, you know, women as women and not trying to fit them in any type of other box. And I had all male consultants on my campaign, and I know most women do. And I think when you're telling your story and being true to yourself and running a movement and not a campaign, it can be really beneficial to have another woman on the team, you know, helping to really push that forward. And I think one of the biggest mistakes and challenges candidates can make, especially young women, is to try to fit into a box that they shouldn't. I think we have the unique opportunity with the women's movement right now is to be true to ourselves, to run as ourselves, and to really change the entire conversation in politics.
Debbie Walsh is Whitney Smith and the like spitting in the wind. Can you use the movement to change the metrics, the calculus of politics in the United States?
Yeah, you know, I think before the Virginia primary, before the Virginia general election this past November, I might have been a little more, maybe, perhaps. But we've seen some results in the last few months that have really changed some of our understandings of the conventional wisdom about American politics. So in Virginia, you had of the surge in women running for the House of Delegates in their state legislative races, which are off-year elections, and well over two-thirds of those women who ran were, in fact, challengers, and challengers traditionally win only about, 5% of the time. Incumbents have a much better shot. Those are tough races.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, 30% of those women who ran as challengers, Democratic women who ran as challengers against incumbent Republican men, mostly men, they won. And so I think that right now we're looking at a moment where things may be a little bit more, may be a little upside down, and we may not be able to rely so much on what we consider our conventional wisdom. And I just want to also add that I think what Marianne was talking about earlier in terms of term limits has been a huge issue in Ohio. It's been a huge issue for other term-limited states, and it's so ironic because when term limits were implemented in places like Ohio, one of the arguments for term limits was that this would help women and it would open up the doors to representation for women. And in fact, what we found is the women get termed out just the way the men do, and then they end up getting replaced by men. Because at the core of all this is so much about the recruitment process and who's asking people to run and who they are asking. And there needs to be, and I think in a place like Ohio with term limits, there's a tremendous opportunity to do some really targeted recruitment for women candidates in the state legislature on both sides of the aisle, because you know, because of term limits, where those openings are coming. And so you have a little bit longer of a runway, and you can do a little bit of planning, and you can really target some of those seats to find good Democratic and Republican women to run in districts that match their partisan affiliation.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about women in politics post-2016. Marianne Sharkey, talk about what Whitney said about all of her consultants being men when she was running for public office. I mean, that's another layer of this story.
It is another layer.
Consultants tend to be men.
You know, I've done quite a few campaigns.
I know.
Years. And often I'm the only woman in the room, and it's very disturbing to me. I would agree. I think that guys tend to pick other guys to work on their campaigns, I found that true with basically the two parties. They do the same thing. They have sort of these male friends who I assume they golf with or drink with or whatever they do.
Mm-hmm.
And they all get together and they work on campaigns together. And women pretty much get shut out of the process. And I would agree. I think women candidates could use the perspective of a woman consultant.
What about that, Debbie Walsh, about women in the background, not at the forefront, but in the background working?
Sure. We don't have good data on the proportions of women and men in those sort of political operative professions. But I think women tend to be kind of ghettoized in the world of fundraising. But a lot of the strategic planning and that piece of the world of consulting, I think, is largely male. And I think they often will do a disservice to the women who are running because they don't think about the way campaigns may be different when you're messaging for a woman candidate, what works for women candidates. There's some great consultants out there, women consultants, mm-hmm. who really understand the candidacies of women and some of the challenges that they face that are unique. I mean, the kinds of things like the fact that women are more likely to be put up on a pedestal when they run, and so if they fall, it's a really big fall, and it's hard to get back up again, as opposed to men who are not. I think about it sometimes as the men are on a curb and the women are up on, the Eiffel Tower. And so the fall is that much greater and that much harder to climb back from. You know, these are some things that we know from research, how voters perceive women candidates. Also that women candidates are perceived to not necessarily assumed to be qualified. It's something that women have to prove in ways that men do not. And that's something that sometimes male consultants might not take into consideration.
Whitney Smith,
you
told me before we went on the air that you've been approached about a couple different offices, running for a couple different offices. What are you thinking about with that?
How would you
do it differently?
I would love to just kind of say it from a candidate's point of view. When I ran for office specifically, I know a lot of times I would have meetings and they would look to my campaign manager as the candidate because Whitney can be could be a male or female name. And I kind of got it kind of became a running joke almost that people would always assume that I wasn't the candidate, maybe my age and definitely because I was a woman. But I feel that when you're a woman running for office, and from my experience, you have to deal with a lot of double standards. And I felt that even my press coverage, while it was extensive and I've always appreciated it, there were certain things that were constantly mentioned about me that I found really hurt my credibility.
Like what?
My age was always published in print whenever it was talked about. And my opponent, who was a middle-aged male incumbent, his age was never once mentioned.
Interesting.
And also my marital status was something that was a hot topic. My partner was written about in articles, and not once was that ever my opponent's case. So those kind of doubles.
That's that pedestal, do you think? Part of that pedestal?
I think it's just a double standard.
Okay.
And almost like a fascination with how can a young single woman be running for office, and more, is she qualified, based on that? And I think that a male counterpart with my same age, also same marital status, wouldn't have those questions arise. And I haven't seen them ever arise. To date, I've worked on over 300 races across the country, and I can really relate to being the only female consultant in the room. It's actually been pointed out many times saying, well, what does the woman think when certain issues were brought up? And, for any candidate, I think you would want and really benefit from having, diverse consultants, especially now with the women's movement that I was just at on January 20th here in Columbus. Mm-hmm. And I saw, thousands of women coming together in front of the state house. It was incredibly inspiring, but no one there was saying, what party are you? We were all there, you know, united under the same understanding that, that things have to change.
Marianne Sharkey, what about that media piece? I can't imagine you or I would ever do that, mention one person's age without mentioning the others. But what about that? How does the media cover women?
Well, I think it's true. I mean, I think you also see women are more judged by their appearance, too. And you'll hear, you'll just see subtle things in print or just on TV watching it that they'll focus more on, you know, say the full body shot of a woman as opposed to a head shot for a man. And it's very subtle things like that that do occur. And I'll be honest with you, sometimes it's just, people don't think about it, so it is the job of the, you know, the consultant, someone like me, to, you know, call up someone and say, hey, you know, how about giving a fair shake here? You're going to mention her age, you know, what about his age? And you know, you just have to sort of, you know, rattle the cages and make sure that they become aware of this sort of subtle sexism.
You know, speaking of more overt sexism, there's a kerfuffle at the State House over comments made at a recent going away party for a staffer among the Republicans. I wondered about maybe Debbie Walsh, what the parties are doing to recruit women, and once women are holding public office, what they do to keep them. Are they nurturing them the way they should? Do you have any sense about that?
Yeah, you know, I think if you just look at the numbers, there's a tremendous disparity between the where women are partisanly. So, for instance, in Congress, Democratic women are about a third of the Democratic caucus, whereas on the Republican side, women make up only about 9 or 10% of the caucus. The Democratic Party is clearly not at political parity, so I don't want to give them, you know, a pass now and say, well, you've done your work. It's all good now. But I think there are more resources on the Democratic side for women candidates, and I think there's more active recruitment. On the Republican side, there has not been as much, and it shows in their numbers. And I think part of it has to do with a little bit of what Marianne was talking about earlier, where, you know, there were women like Joanne Davidson and Betty Montgomery who were serving in Ohio. But these were more moderate Republicans. And these days, I think it's harder to get elected as a moderate Republican. Who is turning out in Republican primaries are the most conservative voters. And those voters may be even more resistant than others to the concept of women in leadership. And that's a real challenge. You know, we see something called the gender gap. We've seen it since the early 80s, where women are likely to vote differently than men, and they're more likely to vote Democratic than men, less likely to vote for the Republican candidate than their male counterparts. Now, that is a benefit that has always fallen to the Democratic candidate, regardless of gender, except for in a few very rare occasions. And one of them that we still talk about is when Betty Montgomery ran for one of her terms as Attorney General, where there was a gender gap and women were more likely to support the Republican candidate than the men. So it gives you a little bit of insight into some of that challenge on the Republican side.
Just we only have time for a last word from Whitney Smith, but have you been recruited by Democrats to run for office, given your stand on some of the issues and that kind of a thing?
I have been asked by a few elected officials who are Democrats to switch parties and run as a Democrat. And I feel, you know, especially living in Columbus, I'm definitely not a Democrat, but the national side of the Republican Party and the president, I don't align with. I'm a millennial as well, so I feel like I'm, you know, in search of the right fit of where I should stand.
Well, Whitney Smith, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Whitney Smith is former Republican political candidate, founder of WillWorkForWomen.com. That's a consulting firm exclusively focused on female candidates. Also, Marianne Sharkey, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Marianne Sharkey, public affairs consultant, former communications director for Ohio Governor Bob Taft, and former political columnist and journalist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And also Debbie Walsh, thanks again for joining us, Debbie. Always appreciate your time.
So happy to do your show.
Debbie Walsh is the director of the Center for American Women and Politics at Rutgers University. Coming up, we're going to hear about the first woman to run for president in the United States. It was in the 19th century, and she was a native of Ohio. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The first woman to run for president of the United States didn't have the right to vote herself and was too young under the constitutional law to actually serve. But none of that stopped Ohio native Victoria Woodhull from running in the 1872 election. She was a trailblazer in many areas, and her story has gained renewed interest from historians, documentarians, and filmmakers. Joining us now is historian and professor at Columbus State Community College, Judith Dann. Welcome.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
Judith Dann will be giving a talk called The Courageous Voice of the First Woman to Run for President on February 8th at the Columbus State Community College. For more information, visit the link at our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Victoria Woodhull was, you know, when I was just reading about her this morning, and she, you described her as somebody who was ahead of her time. And as I was reading about her, I thought she's out of time. She's like a time traveler. She's no way.
Right.
She was born into what she was born into at the time in which she was born into it and lived the life she did.
And what she
came
did,
from,
right.
Her roots were horrible, it sounded like. Tell us.
Yeah, she was born in Homer, Ohio, which is where I live, and it's a small rural community. We know that she and her family lived in poverty and of very dubious circumstances. Now, a lot of stories about her family, I think, have become legend, and some of my colleagues and I were doing quite a lot of research to try to sort that out to see if they really were as untoward as the legend says. But nonetheless, she didn't have an education. She only had maybe 3 years total education, became self-taught, and rose out of these rather desperate circumstances. And she became one of the most famous women in America and one of the greatest trailblazers.
She, her daughter, her sister, Tennessee,
yes.
I love the name. They had unusual careers as clairvoyants and then stockbrokers.
Yes.
She married very young to an abusive alcoholic philanderer.
Right.
She was just 15.
Right. Right. She was 15. And some say that she married him to get away from her father. But I kind of wonder about that because her father stayed with her entire life. I think they had quite a close relationship. But yes, she did marry very young to Canning Woodhull, and it was a very rocky marriage. She even said that she aged 10 years in one day because of the abuse and the emotional abuse that he lodged at her. And she did divorce him, and which is one of the reasons I think that she comes down and gains the reputation that she did. You just didn't do that.
Back then.
In the mid-19th
century. Plus, she had
two
children as well, right?
And she had two children by him, and the first one was disabled. He was mentally disabled, and we don't quite know why. But Victoria very astutely made the connection between her husband and her child, saying it was his defectiveness that caused the problem with her child. And so she was a very early advocate of medical knowledge and prenatal care. You know, Victoria was such a woman of firsts, you know, first woman to run for president. First woman, one of the first women stockbrokers on Wall Street. She was the first woman to speak before Congress, a congressional committee, and all of these great firsts. But she also had so many other platforms, and that's what inspires me. She just was an amazing, amazing, inspirational woman. One of those is her advocacy of children and prenatal care. And she was saying if a woman is going to take care of a child, an unborn child, she needs to have education about her body. So she advocated sex education for women.
Which was shocking.
And you don't use that word. You don't even use that word. So I think if she were to look back wherever she is to look at us today, she would just be amazed that we are able to discuss and contemplate these issues in such an open way.
How did she get involved in women's rights and other activism?
She moved to New York and ended up befriending none other than Cornelius Vanderbilt, she and her sister Tennessee, and they did a little mediumship work for him and made themselves millionaires. They literally earned probably about $700,000.
He shared some insider knowledge about to invest in.
She would give that to him, and then he would give her a little kickback. So they became millionaires in their own right, and then that's what allowed them to open a newspaper publishing company, become stockbrokers on Wall Street. And I think she just saw her whole life this inequity amongst women and men, and she had a voice, and she was going to voice it.
She ended up taking care of her first husband as well.
Yes, and that's why if I were to say something about Victoria, it would be absolutely her humanitarianism. Yes, she was a trailblazer. Yes, she was a first on all these things. But to me, her humanitarianism is what stands out. For her son, she never gave up custody. Her son, she always stayed by him.
In a time when it would have been very common to institutionalize,
yes, right? Absolutely. He was always with either her or family members until the day he died. And she took care of him until the day she died. And then she was able, by this point, she had divorced Woodhull. She had remarried, was living in New York, and Woodhull was having a very difficult time with health issues, financial issues. And she took him in, and she and her then husband, Colonel James Blood, took care of him. And she was vilified in the press. And they said, ah, see, here she is. She's a polygamist. And she said, he was my husband living under this roof. I am now living with my now husband. And she says, and I would do this again. Given any other circumstance, she says it's the human thing to do. So she really, as I would say, took one for the team a lot of ways. She recognized how much suffering she and her sister both endured just by their reputation, death threats, just all of the conditions she had to live with. But she said we would do it again in a heartbeat because it was the right thing to do.
She did not have a great relationship with other leaders in the women's suffrage movement, right?
Well, at first she did, actually. She was friends with Susan B. Anthony, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Paulina Wright Davis, all of the major hitters. And they really liked her as well, and they supported her. We've uncovered some letters in the Southern Illinois University archives that show Susan B. Anthony was one of her greatest fans and supporters. Elizabeth Cady Stanton was a supporter of hers for years afterwards. But I think one of the problems was that they had to back away from Victoria a bit because she got herself in this trouble with the law, with the Beecher Tilton scandal. And that's kind of the beginning of the end for her, at least her American career. She couldn't tolerate there are three words that Victoria advocated all the time, and it doesn't matter what: freedom, love, and truth. And she had such a problem with truth. She wanted truth out in the media, truth in journalism, truth in society. And she was being vilified for her quote unquote free love ideas, meaning that she was advocating marriage reform. Women should be able to get out of abusive relationships if necessary, which she did. And so they were vilifying her. And she finally, after sitting on the story for months, she said, I can't take it anymore. And she published this breaking scandal of Henry Ward Beecher, one of the great ministers in the
East. And also the brother of the famous author Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Yes, yes. Right. And so Harriet Beecher Stowe did not like her at all. But Henry Ward Beecher's other sister, Isabella, was a fan of Victoria's. They were friends for years. But that kind of broke it out, put her on the iffy end of journalism, and they had to somehow stop this woman.
It was true, by the way.
It was true.
What they published.
Yes. But they ended up nabbing her on a law, the Comstock Act, that says you are not allowed to disseminate pornographic material through the mail. Now, she wasn't mailing things, but she was publishing it. But a few of her papers were put into the mail for sale, and that's how they got her. So she and Tenney and her husband, Colonel Blood, spent election day from presidential election in prison.
Why did she – what spurred her to run for president in the first place?
I think just she began advocating for women's voice. She was the first woman to speak before a congressional committee about woman's right to vote. And it was a very logical argument. The butler, the man that kind of set this up, allowed her to do it, was in support. But ultimately, the end of this congressional meeting, they said, yeah, that's a very impassioned speech by Mrs. Woodhull, but let's just ignore it. And she just said, I think she was thinking, I can't do it. Let's go the next step and let's try to change things.
Frederick Douglass was her quote unquote running mate.
Yeah.
That's she was running against Grant.
She was running against Ulysses S. Grant. A lot of people said even God couldn't defeat in the election. But we're uncovering things that I truly believe that she and Grant had a friendship there. I think this could really open up Ulysses S. Grant. We know that she knew Grant. We have documentation that she was allowed special privileges to go into the presidential mansion whenever she came. She didn't have to wait.
After the election?
Before.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that Ulysses Grant's father knew the girls and used to write poetry to the Claflin girls, which would be Victoria, Tenney, and another sister. So there was a connection there, and we're just starting a very exciting search to try to figure that out. So I think this idea and this women's movement stretches far more into other figures, historical figures, than what we imagine.
Did she identify with her Ohio roots?
Always.
Okay.
Yes, she did. There were times when she would make up things, but she always always said that she was from Homer. She came back to Homer after she had moved to England. So definitely she always.
Oh, she did.
Yes, she did come back, and her sister or her daughter came through. I actually knew some people who, as a child, saw Zula come through Homer.
How many children did she end up having?
Victoria had two.
Okay, just two. Okay.
Right, Byron and Zula. Right, and with no descendants from either one.
Did they even count the votes for her when she ran for president? Do we know how many she received?
No, I've read in some biographies that there is a number over 1,000, but I don't know where they're getting that. We're trying very hard to look at the actual primary sources. We don't have a ballot. Never seen that. No, but there is kind of an interesting thing that she did vote. Victoria tried to vote the year before. And there's an article about it in one of the New York papers where she and four other women snuck up to the ballot box and they were stopped by the guard. And of course, Victoria has to lecture them on the Constitution and why. No, I do in fact have to.
I thought that was an interesting take on the whole thing. Is she believed, was it the 14th?
14th and 15th Amendment.
Already gave women the right to
vote.
Yes.
She says all you need to do is recognize that we already have that right.
Universal suffrage, right.
Exactly. Exactly. It didn't define what gender. So while she's lecturing, she always used to carry a pocket constitution with her, and she whipped that out. And while she was arguing and lecturing with the guard, one of the women in her group voted. And it's very interesting because in this article, then they went and fished out her vote, and they said, and see who she voted for? Oh, this is why women shouldn't vote. This is why women should not have the right to vote, because look who they vote for.
And who did she vote for?
I don't remember the name, but yeah. So it's an interesting
Did she abandon politics after that?
She did. Yeah, she never ran for another office. When she moved to England, she continued lecturing. She continued into her humanitarian ideas. She continued a paper. It was called The Humanitarian, was her publication in England. So she definitely continued her work a little bit more on the peaceful, laid-back side than what it was.
We're just about out of time, but there are people who are interested in her story. There's documentaries.
Yes. The Rao sisters have created this. It's an unbelievable documentary called The Coming Woman, and that's hopefully going to be coming out very soon. We've got the Columbus State series, and then the series inspired by her. And at the Robbins Hunter Museum, we've got an amazing 3-year roundtable series, not about Victoria, but inspired by her, of her legacy, and how we can listen to her voice again.
You can learn more about that. Go to Courageous Convos, Courageous, C-O-M-V-O-S.com to learn more about that. And Judith Dann, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was an honor to be here.
Judith Dann is a historian and professor at Columbus State Community College. Thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.